Welcome to the Matt Haycock Show, a podcast about business, money, and life. Matt has been making money and making mistakes for over 20 years. And in this podcast, he shares his thoughts and stories so you can improve your business, finances, and life, whilst hopefully avoiding the mistakes he and others have made along the way. Listen in and level up.
The road to becoming a key person of influence is essentially, initially, they become very good at what they do. So they've got good functional skills. But then there becomes a turning point. And the turning point is where they stop trying to be a better accountant, a better photographer, a better cook, and they start telling the stories. They start getting in front of people. They start building relationships at scale.
Hey guys, it's Matt Haycock here, and welcome to another episode of the Matt Haycock Show, where today I have got with me Daniel Priestley. And Daniel is an author, an entrepreneur, and most interesting for me personally, he's an international expert in brand building, personal brand building. And he has a book, The Key Person of Influence, which I've actually read a couple of times. You can actually, I don't know if you can see how dog-eared it is from the amount of times I've been reading it by the pool on holiday. But looking forward to having Daniel here. And as I often say on these podcasts, you know, one of the greatest benefits for me is that I actually get to meet people like Daniel and other guests who I have my own, selfish personal questions for. And undoubtedly today is going to be one of those days. But I just want to start this off before Daniel speaks by reading just a couple of paragraphs from Daniel's book, just to frame it. Daniel doesn't know I'm going to do this, but I'm sure he knows his book inside out, and he knows exactly where I am. This is page 18, Daniel, and the title is Looking Good and Going Nowhere. And it says, I know an accountant. He's a great accountant. However, he's not happy, and I know why. When he was 18 years old, fresh out of high school, his best thinking was to study for this job. He was good at maths and economics, and for all the right reasons, it made sense at the time to study and get into the accountancy profession. But today he's frustrated. He's brilliant at what he does, but he still has to compete on price. Like most of the people in his industry, he thinks that the key to making more money is doing more study and on the technical aspects of his job. But unfortunately for him, everyone in his line of work is focused on getting more qualifications, and he finds himself constantly playing catch-up. Regardless of how much he earns, he still feels that he's only slightly ahead of the game. Now, I can go on, but I think you get the gist. And I know that describes many of you guys listening to this, watching this, etc. So listen in, listen to what Daniel's got to say, because as someone who is permanently working on building my personal brand and knowing the benefits that it creates, you know, the higher margins you can charge, the greater opportunities you can get. It's going to be great to listen to it from the expert himself. So long intro, but thanks a lot for being here, Daniel.
Thanks for having me.
Tell me, I guess let's start at the beginning for you. Not the beginning, but I know in your book it talks about the fact that you were kind of dropped in England in 2006 and started on your journey. So maybe if we focus from then and tell us how it all began.
Yeah, so in 2006 I arrived in the UK with a suitcase and a credit card. I didn't know anyone. I had set myself a challenge to set up a business and launch a company without exceeding the limit of my credit card. Mind you, it was a reasonably healthy credit card. I'd been somewhat successful in Australia beforehand, building a business prior to 2006, but came to the UK, and it was actually my first trip above the equator. I'd never been above the equator until I moved to London. So I moved to London, didn't know anyone, and I set up a business, and within, I think, the first year we did about £2 million, and then after that we did about £4 million worth of revenue. So kind of, you know, jumped straight in and got going. Did a launch campaign, generated about £800,000 straight off the launch campaign. And one of the keys to that was starting to network with the key people of influence in London. So I went straight in and looked for who are the top 30 people in my industry, in my space, who are the ones that already have big databases, who are the ones that already have a lot of trust in the industry, who are the ones that have spent the last 10, 20 years building their brand and reputation, and then how do I work alongside them in order to partner with them and create joint ventures with them. Essentially that was the key to it, just coming in and working with people who already had the established brands and reputations. So very rapidly, we ended up working with Dragons from Dragon's Den, and we worked with extremely successful people who'd built multi-million and sometimes multi-billion dollar companies. We worked with a particular couple who had a 500,000 person database, and we got them on board with what we're doing. So it was essentially that kind of very fast launch. And one of the things that kind of shocks me is that, you know, in many cases, people who have lived in London for 15, 20 years are still struggling to get past 100 or 200,000 of revenue. And, you know, we kind of burst straight in and did millions of revenue pretty much straight away, not with a dissimilar product, not with some sort of brand new Facebook or Google kind of product. It was just a, you know, fairly normal kind of thing that anyone could do. So the key distinction that I got from all of that and that people kept asking me about was the distinction around key people of influence and just the idea that every industry revolves around a very small number of people. There's probably 30 to 50 people in every industry who really have a brand and reputation and everyone knows them and everyone wants to work with them. And essentially you need to become one of those people and work with those people in order to get things done. So that was kind of like the first insight. I didn't write the book until 2009-10, but it was essentially, you know, building a business based on that insight.
And tell me, so going back to when you were applying those principles, you know, 2006 onwards, did you know what you were doing then? Insofar as you may not have written the book, but did you already have this strategy and these principles in place, or were you just kind of going with gut at that point of what felt right? And as time went on, you formulated it into more of a structured strategy.
Yeah, so I hadn't written about it, so I hadn't kind of put it into those words, but I certainly had strong inclinations about how things worked. My background in Australia was from 19 to 21, I worked in a fast growth startup. We went from zero to 6 million in the first 2 years. We hired a team of 60 people. We went from around the kitchen table, three of us around the kitchen table, to 60 of us in a big office in Melbourne. And that was my first 2 years in business, basically being employee number three of a very fast growth company. So I was very close with the CEO and founder. I was very close to the action and got a view into how fast growth companies evolve that would be much, you know, a much greater visibility into that world than most 19, 20-year-olds. At 21, I started my own company. I left that company and started my own company, and it became a very fast growth company in Australia. It went from 1 to 10 million, 0 to 1 million in its first year, and then 1 to 10 million in the 3 years after that. So before the age of 25, I'd built a business that was doing 10 million a year in sales. I'd done some really significant partnerships. I'd spoken at up to 170 events a year in Australia. You know, so I wasn't wet behind the ears. I hadn't come down in the last shower, but I certainly was absolutely starting from scratch. And in London, people tend to not care very much about what you've done in Australia. They tend to sort of think that Australia must be a very different market to London. So I knew very clearly that I had to be working closely with the existing key people of influence in the UK. But I had good chat and I had a clear pitch, and I put together all the materials and I'd put together a well thought through joint venture agreement. So all of those things were in place.
So, and I mean, I may be jumping the gun a bit on some of the tactics you'll explain to us. But I mean, one of my questions, and I'm sure this is what, you know, many people listening or watching are thinking, is, so you said you've come to London, and that you knew it was the best growth plan for your business to go and start finding and partnering with these key people of influence, which makes complete sense, and which you did. You know, you talk about Dragons and people with huge databases, etc. But why did they want to talk to you, and what, I guess, you know, what were you doing to get yourself in front of them, and what were you offering? Because, you know, I'm sure people like Dragons and anyone who is a key person of influence, anyone who's got something to offer, probably has their moat around them and their, you know, and their gatekeepers. You know, how do you get through that door?
Well, with big high profile speakers, it's pretty simple. They normally want a high fee to come and speak for an hour. So anywhere between £5,000 and £10,000 normally gets them to jump in the car and come and speak at a conference. And normally you only put down a 20% deposit to book them. So one of the things I would do is, you know, I'd book top profile speakers and pretty much I'd put down maybe, you know, £2,000-£2,500 as the deposit with the balance paid after, you know, after we did a deal. So it was actually surprisingly simple to book top profile speakers if you just have a 20% deposit for their speaking fee. As soon as you've got those people in place, other people are quite interested in talking to you because they've heard. So if you say, you know, I've been in city for 5 minutes and I'm already doing a gig with one of the top entrepreneurs in town, very rapidly people are like, oh, I've heard of that person. I'll come and have a meeting with you. The other thing that I did is I booked a fancy restaurant and a private dining area that could hold about 30 people. And I negotiated a good rate for a two course dinner and a bottle of wine on the tables. And essentially I just contacted a lot of the top influencers that I'd done my research on and said that I've arrived from Australia. I'm setting up a new company. We're doing a set of speaking engagements with these speakers. We're going to be doing a launch event and I want to present to you what we're up to and how you could, you know, be involved and how we might work together. I've booked a nice restaurant. There's going to be 30 of, I've identified the 30 top influencers in London. Your name's on the list if you want to join us. We're going to be having a dinner party. It's exclusive. It's all on me. I'm paying for everything. You just come along and join me for dinner with 30 of the top influencers that I've identified. And they, you know, they'd always say, oh, who else is going? And I'd say, well, you know, on the invitation list is this name, this name, this name, this name. Okay, I know those people. I'll come along and I'll have dinner with you. Why not? So one of the very first things I did about 3 weeks after arriving here is hosted a dinner with, I think we had 28 people at the first dinner. You know, it was just a nice night. I walked around and booked people into my diary and said, look, you know, it's not a good time to talk business tonight, but can we make a time to meet? So we made a time to meet at a private members club called Adam Street that I joined. Basically I started just putting together some joint ventures and saying, look, what I'd really like is for you to promote the launch event and we'll give you 100% of every ticket you sell. It's all yours. And we'll also name you as a sponsor. We'll put you on the media board. We'll promote you back to our database. So there'll be money and recognition in it for you. So I started structuring those kind of deals pretty quickly. I think out of 28, something like 24 agreed to do the joint venture. So I'm racking my brains. It's 2006, but it was certainly a good solid number of people jumped on board the promotion.
No, I mean, and that's very interesting what you say, because you know, a lot of the time, you know, this is a question I get asked about, you know, how do I get in front of these certain people, and it's, you know, something I regularly talk about on both my own videos or when people are interviewing me, and I always talk about the fact that, you know, you've got to have something to offer these people. When you get a random LinkedIn message from somebody saying, hey, it's great, why don't we connect and have a cup of tea, you know, well, you want to have a cup of tea because you want to have it with me. I don't give a shit about having it with you. You know, you're going to take up my morning. You're going to take up one of my lunches of the week.
The worst one, which I just hate, and you know what it is, right? I hate when people say, can I pick your brains? And it's like literally, it's just purely and simply, I've got a problem and I'd like you to go out of your way to give me free consulting. Completely. And, you know, and sometimes they say, can I pick your brains and I'll buy you a cup of coffee, as though you know, as though I'm so excited by the idea that you're going to pick up the £3 for a cup of coffee. And it's like, you know, in some cases I have to come back and sort of say, you know, as much as I'd absolutely love that incredible offer that you've put to me, I do have other things that I can be doing to be able to afford coffee.
And that's the thing, I think, you know, it's very important for people, you know, listening and watching to appreciate that all these people you want to get in front of, you know, by virtue of the fact that they are a key person of influence, you know, they've got very busy diaries and they've got their own money to do what they want to do. So, you know, so you have to be able to offer them something.
And also, most of the time they get approached 100 times a week. So on my LinkedIn, I get 100 inbound inquiries a week. Every single week, 100 people message me. So the whole, you know, you've got to keep that in mind. If you've noticed someone because you've read their book or something like that, there is actually, you know, there'll be quite a lot of people who have done the same.
That's a double-edged sword of being a key person of influence, isn't it? You can get in front of who you want to, but then you get bothered 100 times a week. Well, look, let's not spoil the whole book, but obviously we're kind of whetting the appetite of people who want to you know, become that key person of influence. I mean, what are some of the principles? You know, what are some of the tactics of how you can take yourself from being, as you would say, functional to vital?
Yeah, so the idea is that if you look at most key people of influence in any industry, so every industry revolves around these key people of influence. There's a small number of people who their names always come up in conversation. They attract opportunities, they make more money, they have more fun. That's the people we're talking about, and every industry's got them. So the road to becoming a key person of influence is initially, they become very good at what they do. So they've got good functional skills. You know, Gordon Ramsay can cook. And, you know, that famous photographer is a good photographer, great photographer. And that, you know, that accountant who gets a lot of press is actually a great accountant, right, and has got a lot of experiences. But then there becomes a turning point. And the turning point is where they stop trying to be a better accountant, a better photographer, a better cook, and they start telling the stories. They start getting in front of people. They start building relationships at scale, and they start bringing their own personality, their own take on things, their own story into the mix. And that's where we sort of, I kind of define in the book two layers. There's the functional layer, which is all the functional skills that everyone in the industry has to have. And then there's this thing called vitality. And vitality is, if you look it up in the dictionary, there's two meanings. Vitality means irreplaceable. So, you know, if you take it away, a vital organ is a pretty irreplaceable thing to have. And then a life force actually gives you life, or brings life into it. So if someone is described as being full of vitality, that, you know, it's full of life force, or if they are described as being vital to the project, it means we can't do it without them. So essentially what your goal is in being a key person of influence is vitality, right? The irreplaceable life force of the industry, the irreplaceable life force of a project. You know, so it's someone who people just absolutely want to get involved, have to have involved. And if you can be that person, then you just get absolutely swamped with opportunities, and they're great opportunities, and the best ones filter the top. So I talk about five skills that most people don't focus on that they must focus on if they want to move from functional to vitality. So the first skill is pitching. And that is the ability to pitch things into existence, the ability to enroll others into a vision, the ability to get someone to quit their job and come and work with you, the ability to get someone to do a joint venture with you, the ability to sell a product from stage. All of that is a pitching skill. So you can have someone who's highly functional, but they can't pitch very well, and they'll get the commoditized rate.
By pitch, I presume we can substitute the word communicate with that as well. You know, so basically, having great communication skills.
I feel like communication would water it down a little bit. Pitching is, see, I can communicate something to you which you could clearly understand, but you might not act upon it. Pitching is a skill where you're actually enrolling people into a behavioral change or some sort of activity that they wouldn't have otherwise done. So, for example, there are plenty of people who have great communication skills who could have explained why racial inequality was a bad thing, but it took Martin Luther King to pitch into existence the I Have a Dream speech and to get the wheels moving in the right direction, right? So pitching is about movement. It's about people doing something differently that they wouldn't have otherwise done. So communication skills doesn't cut it. I meet plenty of people who are clear communicators, but they don't inspire action. And I also meet people who don't necessarily have the greatest communication skills, but they can get people to act. They can get people to do things differently. And that's what we're talking about. We're talking about behavioral change. We're talking about, I wasn't planning on going and buying that thing, right? And then Steve Jobs told me about it and I had to buy it. I woke up this morning not knowing what an iPad is, and now I have to have one because Steve Jobs pitched it effectively. So it's pitching is that ability to enroll someone into a vision and to get their action around it. The other thing that pitching is different is that communication skills often describes what's going on and what is, and pitching often is something that revolves around a vision, what could be. So it's a little bit about, there's a real kind of bent with pitching that you're enrolling people into something that's not quite there yet. So, you know, I might be able to sell you a car if I can see the car and you can see the car and I can tell you about the features, advantages and benefits of the car. Pitching is more the idea of, imagine a car that has no engine, that's fully powered by electricity. You know, imagine a car that's completely emits no exhaust, right? That Elon Musk style, imagine how things could be different and have you buy into that. That's pitching.
Perfect. Well, sorry for the interruption.
No, it's a great distinction. I'm really glad you slowed me down there, because that actually is something that people easily blend together. And I just want, it's important to make that distinction. The next one is publishing content. Anything that people can read, watch, listen to, or do online, podcasts, videos, scorecards, books, any of that sort of stuff that people are interacting with. So if you're publishing videos, if you're publishing audios, if you're publishing written documents, if you're publishing articles on LinkedIn, if you're publishing books on Amazon, that is that published content. There is no such thing as a key person of influence who doesn't publish their ideas. So all key people of influence. In fact, it's very, very hard to find someone who's up on a big stage who doesn't have a book. It's very, very rare. If you go and look at the speaker list for every major conference in the world, pretty much everyone who sets foot on the stage, unless they're the CEO of, I was about to say the CEO of Microsoft, but the CEO of Microsoft wrote a book. So, you know, unless they're a major CEO of a major company and then they've not written a book, every other person has written a book. If they're on a big stage. So publishing is a way for people to discover your ideas, for those ideas to spread. You know, we live in a world where there's this amazing technology, this engine that will go out and find anything on the planet that's been published. But if you don't publish, then it can't find it. So, you know, Google has the ability to bring the world to you if only you'll publish online. But if you don't publish, Google can't find you. So publishing is that second step.
Cool.
Yep. So the third one is product ecosystem. You need a great way of making money. If you don't have a product ecosystem, you could be a great key person of influence. You could have 500,000 followers on Instagram. If you've got no products to make money, then you're still living in mum and dad's bedroom, a spare bedroom, or your bedroom. You're not making any money. So you need to have a good solid product ecosystem. There needs to be a way of making money. And critically, you need a way of making money that doesn't involve your time. So what most people have is a way of making money that involves their time. So as soon as they elevate their profile just a little bit, suddenly people swamp in and buy up all their time, and then they've got no time to elevate their profile. So then they go and do the work, and then they run out of clients. So they elevate up a little bit. People come in and buy their time, and then they go under the radar to do the work. So if we want to go exponential, we need a set of products that will scale, and we need a set of products that are going to not involve a linear progression of time. The amount of time to deliver to 100 is the same, roughly the same as delivering to 10, as to delivering to 1,000. So,
and have you got some commentary and advice on what on some products that would maybe fit many, many, many sectors? You know, that are scalable. I mean, I guess in today's world, especially online, you know, things like membership sites and courses, yeah, and books and stuff. But what other advice and thoughts have you got on that?
One of the types of products that's particularly important is what we call a product for prospects. And a product for prospects is a product that it's very, very easy for someone to engage with. And it's like almost it's always the first product. So very common would be an event or a workshop where people buy a cheap ticket or get a free ticket, but then they give up some of their time. And it's a way of touching base. It's a way of having a first experience with a company. So every company needs to have a product for prospects. Now, at the moment, I'm involved in one of my startups is actually a company called ScoreApp.com. And ScoreApp creates a product for prospects called a scorecard. And a scorecard is essentially an online quiz that gives a beautifully designed PDF report at the end. And the PDF report is customized based on how people answer the quiz. So imagine a fitness quiz that asks you questions about how well you sleep and what you eat and whether you exercise and all of those kind of things. At the end, you get, let's say you score quite low on those things. It asks you 40 questions and most of them you say no and you get a bad score. So then it gives you a PDF report that says, it looks like your health and fitness need a bit of work and need a bit of attention. Here's some of the ways to get started in health and fitness. Someone else might score really high and it says, congratulations on scoring well. Here's some advanced moves for taking your fitness to an elite level. So it's customizing the content based on how people interact with the 30 or 40 questions on the quiz. So essentially, that product is it's a game changer for most businesses. We have had hundreds of businesses build themselves a scorecard. And in most cases, it actually replaces the first one or two meetings that you might have with a prospect and takes you straight into a deep conversation with someone. And it filters through and immediately kind of gives you access to people who are interested in what you're doing. So if there was a specific recommendation, it would be scorecards. I personally have used scorecards for the last 5 years. Over 70,000 people have taken our scorecards. And we've generated close to 10 million worth of sales directly from scorecards, and it's also allowed us to keep a fairly lean sales team. I would say that without the scorecard, our sales team would have to be twice as big.
Okay, fantastic. And we got three of the fundamentals. I think there's five fundamentals you've got for being a key person of influence, isn't there? So what do you mean? Pitching.
Well, the fourth one is profile, and that is the obvious one, that if you're a key person of influence, you've got a bit of a profile. People know who you are. You speak at events and you've got a social media following. You might have 5 or 10,000 followers on each of the platforms. You might have people who feature you in the newspaper. Maybe you've had a couple of editorial pieces a year in traditional media. Maybe you're expected to go and speak at certain conferences. So all of that is your profile. It's that idea that if I Google you, there's plenty of stuff that comes up and I might find some images of you up on a stage. I might find some videos of you speaking. I might find some social media sites where you've got lots of people following you. All of those things are what you'd call the profile of a speaker. And certainly you would also expect that there's nothing negative or nothing confusing. So what you obviously don't want in your profile, a lot of people, if I Google a lot of names, I discover that it's a serial killer in Florida or a porn star in California or something like this. And it's a little bit confusing. Or there's crickets, there's really nothing much there. Or unfortunately, there might be some negative reviews, because you've not built a profile, that one or two things that didn't go your way that ended up online, that forms a big part of your profile now because you've not got anything else up there. So there's all sorts of, we've got to have a nice, clean, clear, authoritative profile. Yeah. And the fifth one is actually kind of the step that makes all the money, and that's partnerships. So all the money comes through when you're doing deals. Most businesses have to run around doing deals for customers. They're trying to take on board customer deals. They're trying to make sales. Key people of influence tend to run around doing joint ventures. So they, rather than looking for customers, they look for partners. They look for people who they could do some sort of promotional joint venture with. They look for people who they might partner their brand with a new product. They look for people who they might do an equity partnership where they take a stake in a company. They do a deal where they're looking for distribution deals where they've got a product that they want other people to distribute. So they're out there doing joint ventures and partnerships more so than trying to find customers. So when you can move into partnership, into the world of partnership versus selling, you're definitely moving into that key person of influence circle as well. So those are the big five: pitch, publish, product, profile, partnership. And that's what we want to do in order to become that key person of influence.
And I think, for you guys at home listening to this, one of the things that also Daniel talks about in his book is the fact that you can kind of go from functional to vital in 12 months. By following his processes and systems. So
I'll throw a quick caveat on that. And that is that you've got to have probably done the first 15 years in order to do it in 12 months. You've probably got to have 10, 15 years worth of functional experience. You actually did say go from functional to vital. What you can't do is go from not very functional to vital. So you can't be a 22-year-old straight out of university who suddenly becomes a key person of influence, or that's very rare. That typically makes the news when that happens. But certainly for anyone who's got 10, 15 years worth of great experience at what they do, then rather than running off trying to find the next big thing like Bitcoin or flipping properties or trading Forex or some weird new thing or going and getting an MBA or going and getting a PhD, you can actually build that personal brand really effectively in 12 months.
I think as well, you talk about, you can't go from being not very functional to vital in 12 months. I think, for me in today's world, that there's so much competition in every single sector, and every single niche of every single sector that if you are not 110% competent and expert in your field, then you either need to go back to the beginning or potentially find another field because all the key things we talk about pitching, publishing content, product profile and partnerships, they're nothing more than window dressing that's going to get completely seen through if you're not an expert in your field anyway. So
can I pause on that?
Mm.
So I wouldn't necessarily use the word expert, because there are actually genuine experts out there who aren't really key people of influence. There are people who are like professors at university and, they've written the PhDs and all of that, but they struggle to get cut through. And then there's also people who are proficient. They're actually good at what they do, but they've got the brand, they've got the reputation, they've got the relatability. They're not necessarily a Michelin star chef, but they're actually out there, Ella, Deliciously Ella, she's not a Michelin starred chef or anything, but she's got a great following of people who read her cooking books. So I just want to make a slight distinction that you don't necessarily, a lot of people are intimidated because in their industry they know people who are better than they are, right? So it's like a photographer who knows someone who's a much better photographer, and it's like, I just love, that particular person is phenomenally gifted at the technical side of what they do. So I guess I have to stand in line behind that person and wait, and I can never be better than that person because they're better at the technical photography. So having the functional layer is proficiency, that you absolutely can have a conversation with that expert photographer. You can have a conversation with that Michelin starred chef. And you talk the same language, you've got similar experiences. The difference is that next layer, the vitality layer, can actually be about relatability, building the marketplace. You need to be seen as credible, and you need to be seen as proficient at what you do, and that you know things inside out. But here's where the breakthrough really happens. The really incredible breakthrough happens when you position yourself as a key person of influence, and then you get that phenomenal photographer to come and work with you on a project. You get that amazing Michelin starred chef to come and join in on the project. What's incredible that can happen is as you build a bit more of a brand, if you need someone who has the world's best technical skills, you actually have enough of a a brand to bring them in underneath you, or bring them into the project, not underneath you, but bring them into the project. So the reason I wanted to kind of interrupt there was just this idea that you don't have to be standing in line behind these phenomenal people who are that little bit better than you, or even a lot better than you. If you built yourself the key person of influence brand, you could go and pitch to them and say, would you like to join my project? Would you like to put your, you know, your skills into the creation of something? And then therefore you're not competing with them. You're actually partnering with them.
No, completely right, buddy. And thanks for probably putting me right. Maybe I didn't communicate myself well enough, but yeah, no, 100%. You know, very important what you said there. Well, listen, thanks a lot for being here, Daniel. Where can people find you if they want to hear some more? Where can they get the book? Where can they badger you 100 times a week on LinkedIn?
Well, one of the best things you can do is I'll give you two things. Take the scorecard, Key Person of Influence scorecard. If you Google Key Person of Influence scorecard, you'll come up with a scorecard. You answer 40 questions. It'll give you customized results as to what you should be focusing on in order to get to that next level. And our team will then actually reach out on an email and say, would you like a free copy of the Key Person of Influence book? It's one of our ways of doing marketing that we send people books. We have a couple of hundred books a week that we try and put in the post, which is one of our ways of just building up our community and our following, getting everyone on the same page. So essentially, you can take that scorecard and then get our team to send you a free copy of the Key Person of Influence book, and that would be a great way to get started. And if you then need to badger me on LinkedIn, you can do that as well.
Fantastic. Well, listen, Daniel, thanks a lot for being here. Guys at home and listening and watching, I hope you enjoyed listening to Daniel as much as I enjoyed talking to him. Like I say, it's always great to great for me to be able to pick the brains of these experts. So I'm sure you guys at home enjoy listening to it. If you do, just make sure you like this podcast, like this YouTube video. And if you haven't subscribed already, please make sure you press subscribe so you can get to listen to more great content from guests like Daniel. So thanks a lot for watching. Daniel, thanks a lot for being here.
Thanks, Matt. All the best.
Cheers, buddy.
Thank you for listening to the Matt Haycock Show. For more Matt, check out his YouTube channel. That's youtube.com/Matt Haycock. Or go stalk him on Instagram and Twitter, the Matt Haycock. And we'll see you soon.